I wouldn't know until maybe March 20th.
Because my understanding at this point is that there were four possible cases, the first two of which have been eliminated. The remaining two, one of them involves an assistant professor at the university, but who a person is on leave and has not been coming to the university. That person was sick, but last I read, a day or so ago, had been tested, but the tests weren't back yet. The other person, they wouldn't tell us who it was, which tells me it's a HIPAA issue, which means it's either a protected class, which means either a student or an employee that is a protected class. And in any case, at this point, we don't have a confirmed case on campus, but that just means we're a little ahead of the curve. But I think there's nothing in principle wrong with doing lecturing remotely. And so I'm going to be looking into that, and watch out for an email from me. What I might do is try to run a test. My understanding is that this building is supposed to have all these resources, including, I believe that's a camera on the back wall. So I think that I could run a test in here and let you know on the day when I plan to deliver the lecture from here over possibly Zoom. I haven't decided exactly what mechanism to use. I will know about that pretty shortly, and it could happen as early as Friday. So I'll email everybody tomorrow to let you know if there's any reason for you to come in. Yes?
Zoom does work really well. I have another philosophy professor, and
there's more than one of us?
I'm sorry. Just one. Just you. I think Zoom has been working well, and she's already made the decision to put it on to an online course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think for our course, it's the likely thing. Whether it'll happen this week or only starting Monday, I haven't yet been able to settle. Yes?
Will it be live online or pre-recorded online?
Pre-recorded. Because I'm not going to try to conduct class discussion with 60 people. Zoom is good, but it isn't that good, from what I've heard. That's where the problem comes in. So insofar as what I think I'll do in order to give you the opportunity to ask questions is I think probably what I'll do is create something like a blog through Canvas, where you can ask questions and I can answer them. And you can see what questions others have asked and checked in. How attendance is going to be dealt with in that respect, I really don't know. I'm inclined to regard, I only take attendance because I was persuaded years ago that being paternalistic is sometimes in my own best interest. That is, the paternalism of others has benefited me in my life, and while occasionally offending me, as it often does for everyone, I figured for the subset of people who benefit from paternal, consideration and attention, requiring attendance might be a good thing. But in this case, if we go to online only, it's on you. It's on you to do the reading, watch the lectures, check out the blog, or whatever the hell it's going to be. Okay? And contact me if you have questions. Okay? And probably what I'll do is institute something like an online office hour or two, where you can, it's at this time and you dial into whatever it is. And then, ask questions if you have any. Okay? So I'll make a decision about this in a day or so. But I anticipate that this will happen. It's just a question of whether it starts Friday or Monday. Okay? Okay, good. So any questions other than about that? All right. So David Hume, Scottish philosopher, who among other things, he was an active participant in English culture at the time. He what we now think of as British culture. He was not only fluent in English, it's arguable that the thing Hume was proudest of was not that at the age of 22 or 3 he wrote one of the seminal works in early modern philosophy, the piece, a scaled-down version of which you're reading, but that he had perfected an original and very effective form of essay in English. He was very proud of his creative facility in English. I think you'll find, compared to even Locke, who was writing also in English, and English was Locke's native tongue, Hume is even easier to understand, I think you'll find. And one of the reasons he's easier to understand is that the style of essay that he invented became a dominant approach to essay writing in the academy in English. So it's been modeled. So it's going to seem familiar to you, in part also because it involves a later form of English, which is closer to the one that you learned in your travels in English in this century. So Hume is following directly in the footsteps of John Locke. He is an empiricist. And in the opinion of most who've studied both, he is an attempt to refine Locke, to overcome some problems that Locke seems to have generated with his own approach to empiricism, but which he didn't solve. And in the course of evaluating the sources of these problems, Hume also discovered, cleaned up some other problems that he found in Locke's theory, theory of ideas and theory of mind, theory of mental content, and theory of knowledge, which has been the focus of our course going all the way back to Descartes, that others had not noticed, or not noticed as soon and as clearly as he did. So it's useful in before we get very far into going through Hume's own theory of mental content, theory of mind, theory of knowledge, theory of judgment, how propositions, how statements are justified, and so on. We make some broad comparisons between the empiricism a la John Locke and the empiricism a la David Hume. So among the contrasts that one can't help making is a general one between the realism of Locke and what you get in Hume, which takes a little more, takes a few more words to describe. So by realism in Locke's case, what I mean is he was a metaphysical realist as well as an empirical, an epistemological realist. What do those fancy terms mean? Well, a metaphysical realist simply is someone who says that there is a real world with its own features. There is an actual world. That actual world has a set of essential features, properties, if you like. And then the epistemological realist position is that that world is one that minds like ours are capable of acquiring knowledge about. So there's an actual world and we can know something about it, roughly, captures in very, very broad terms Locke's realism. Another way to see Locke's realism is to notice that he doesn't worry about, even though the distinction between primary and secondary qualities turns on something that requires access to information that Locke himself seems to recognize we lack. Namely, the way the primary qualities exist independent of our ideas of them. Because remember, the distinction between secondary and primary qualities is a distinction that is based on a difference in the kinds of effects in us which those qualities produce. Since a quality is just the power in objects in the external world to cause us to have ideas of sensation, right? And some of them resemble those things in the objects that cause them, and other ideas fail to resemble those causes in the object. But Locke says in a number of places things that suggest that he regards there our access to the real properties of mind-independent objects, those objects that stand as the causes of all of our ideas of sensation, that relationship is indirect. What does that mean? Well, remember, I've talked about indirect realism, which is a view, this was an extra credit question on the exam. It's a position about the relationship between our ideas, mental content that represents things, and the causes of those ideas in the world. The indirect realist says that the information we have about the world only comes by way of something that stands between us and that world. In Locke's case, and in Hume's, sensations, conscious sensations, what Locke calls simple ideas of sensation, and what Hume calls impressions of sensation. Okay. So we don't actually witness the shape of the chair directly. We witness it indirectly through visual and tactile representations of shape. We encountered a problem here that Dr. Molyneux generated, which helps to kind of articulate this problem. That if you haven't, except that what generates the problem initially is just that what we have access to are sensations, and the modes of those sensations require some experience before we know how to interpret that information. But even the information about the shape of the chair, which is supposed to be information about what is an actual feature of the chair, and is supposed to resemble that feature, even that is translated into a visual form and a tactile form, which the Molyneux problem highlights, right? A person was blind, doesn't know what a cube looks like, doesn't know what a sphere looks like, they only know how it feels when you touch it. And that in itself moves you in the direction of a position about the relationship between our ideas and the way things are in the chair that is indirect realistic in its nature. Right? The shape of the chair is being translated into a visual mode of representation, but is not itself a visual thing. A visual thing is a perceived thing. It's a thing as represented through perception. But Locke repeatedly says that what we encounter immediately are effects in us. And effects in us are not objects in the world. To think that effects in us, ideas, are not just resembling, but identical to, are actually what is in the world, is to be a direct realist, to think that our perceptions reveal to us, we just our eyes open into the world as it is, at least in respect to some of its perceived features, and in respect to, if Locke were a direct realist, then he wouldn't have that problem that we talked about, where the whole distinction between primary and secondary qualities requires access to something that Locke does not provide himself access to. The way things are in the chair, independent of the way it affects my mind and produces sensations with different kinds of features. Okay? Yes?
How do I justify direct realism?
I'm tempted to say go ask Mike Humer. Because Mike has a very well worked out direct realism. Essentially, by showing that the problems with direct realism can be solved. And I'll give you some examples just very quickly. I mean, this is, now you've just moved us into a fourth year senior seminar in, you know, early modern epistemology, and that's okay. But that's good. One of the problems that stands in the way of direct realism is that there are phenomena like bent stick, straight stick. So when I stick the stick in the water and I look at it, it looks bent. When I run my hand along it, it feels straight. If my information about the stick, the mind-independent entity, is supposed to be derived from what I perceive in the stick, I have two conflicting perceptions. And people who end up deciding that indirect realism is the best way to go look at this and say, how do we prefer the way it feels to the way it looks? How do we decide which is real, which is the actual feature of the stick? Conventionally, we treat the way it feels, right, when it's in the water and when it's out, that's the stable feature, and we decide, well, the continuing feature, we'll go with the sensory modality touch, which is consistent across multiple encounters in different perceptual situations, whereas the visual encounter changes depending on the medium in which the stick appears. But how do we know that the medium in which the stick appears straight is the real medium? How do we know that air is not distorting the stick and making it look and feel straight, whereas water, maybe water is what's real, right? So how do we make these decisions? Leads us, in order to try to overcome these conflicts, many people have thought, and it's a long chain of reasoning. You can imagine different ways of justifying the conventional common sense approach, right? One way would be to appeal to a style of argument called argument to the best explanation. And I was giving you a kind of version of that just now. The best explanation would be consistent with what the bulk of our evidence suggests, right? When we build a table with the stick, the table has straight, you know, and like we take the stick, it's a pretty smooth stick, and we make one leg of a table. And that table doesn't, you know, when you move chairs around it, it doesn't behave like something that's bent. It behaves like something that's straight. And so you might take the preponderance of the evidence as another approach to defending the claim that no, what the way it feels is the accurate. That's the sense to be trusted. So, but this is how indirect realism gets started over how to resolve this conflict among our sensory, diverse forms of sensory information. And a direct realist resolves this in other ways. If, like, by appeal to the argument to the best explanation or to the preponderance of the evidence or something like that. Okay? I'm not saying it's easy. In fact, I am inclined to think that in the end, there are, and this requires looking down a road at the dialectic to see where these various arguments lead each of the positions. But I'm inclined to think that indirect realism tends to be the more plausible position. So I'm not a very good person to ask how to defend direct realism because I see many problems with it and I have trouble seeing its virtues.
Doesn't it rely on assuming a lot?
I don't think so. I think that it relies on arguments. It relies on arguments that try to establish why we should trust what touch tells us. And you could say that, one way to see it, I'll just give you an example. In respect to the bent stick, straight stick, I mean, the stick we only get that information in rare situations. Most of the time, it's straight. So here's a pragmatic approach. If you think your fishing rod is broken because you dip it in the water, you're going to make a mistake. It's best to trust that it's the same shape as it was before you stuck it in the water. That will work out better for you when you're trying to maneuver it to catch the big one. So on practical grounds, you're better off trusting that that's the actual shape, and this is just an anomaly which can be explained using a theory of vision and refraction and how light bends across a certain kind of medium surface, and so on. So that's an argument to the best explanation, which eliminates the impression that common sense suggests that it's a bent stick, at least part of the time. So anyway, that's how we get to direct realism, if we're hoping to get there. Locke didn't attempt that. Okay, so back to Locke and Hume. So Locke is a realist, and you can see that in the absence of any serious consideration of skeptical challenges to beliefs based on the literal content of perception, even despite these ordinary experiences with conflicts among different senses and the information they deliver to us, leaving aside the dream problem or the evil demon hypothesis or the experience machine or the matrix and so on, okay? Locke just doesn't seem to be moved by that. He has a kind of realist, framework out of which he operates. In that way, he's more like a scientist, less like an epistemologist. Hume, on the other hand, is equally committed to the idea that we can only know about the world whatever is available to us by way of ideas we derive from what we literally perceive through the senses, the five senses, which is our sole source of information about the world. But he looks carefully at the nature of that information. In some ways, he's more careful about it, goes into fine-grained detail about and notices a number of features of what we literally perceive, which is one reason I describe him as a pure phenomenologist. Phenomenology being a person who does philosophy using primarily evidence from the literal conscious phenomena of conscious awareness. Okay. But what he seems to be doing is mapping out the geography that is mental and inspecting it in the way that a zoologist would lay out the geography of the Amazon, with all of the living things and structures in it, through a careful inspection of all of its parts. And Hume is doing a similar thing with the sensorium, fancy sort of Latinate word for the way things appear to your conscious awareness through perception. And then he adds to that an empiricist criterion of meaningfulness, which is like Locke, it is like Locke's correspondence principle. Remember I said that principle provides us with a means of testing ideas drawn from perception to see whether they can be legitimately used in describing and explaining the world of our perceptions or parts thereof. Do you remember? This is what Locke uses to critique the idea of a propertyless substrate, a capital S substance. Since we don't perceive them, because we can't trace the concept of a capital S substance back to original simple ideas of sensation, it's a something we know not what. And since we don't have access, therefore that's Locke using the correspondence principle to limit what ideas are meaningful as sources of, as materiel for explaining the world as we perceive it. And he sorts between the concepts that satisfy that principle, that correspondence principle, the acquisition principle. I'm mixing the two philosophers up. Acquisition principle makes the same claim that the correspondence principle in Hume explains, which is how all information about the world from the domain of perception must be derived from original, for Locke, simple ideas of sensation. For Hume, those originals are called impressions of sensation, and I'll talk to you about why that's an important innovation of Hume's. But the main thing is that this standard for what counts as meaningful information for the empiricist, each of them is essentially the same. Hume is just more rigorous in applying that principle. And by the time Hume is done, a number of other concepts, which Locke never thought to challenge in the way that he challenged the concept of a substance, are also going to be challenged and are going to limit what we can claim, what concepts we can use in describing and explaining the world around us. And it's actually going to lead to at least a moderate form of skepticism about knowledge of the external world, including its existence. And I'll show you how that works. So all of this means that where Locke is a realist, Hume ends up being an anti-realist or a skeptic, depending on what he discovers about a particular concept. It either is something that simply cannot exist in the world as we think of it, because we don't have access to information that supports that concept, right? Or he simply is a skeptic. And these are two ways of taking his critique. It may be that, in fact, things are the way that they appear to us, but we can't establish that because we don't have access to things as they exist independent of the way they appear to us in perception. And Hume is very rigorous and careful about demanding that you find in the literal content of conscious perceptual awareness everything that you are thinking with the concepts you use to describe it. And this is going to lead to a major critique of the concept of cause and effect. The causal relation is going to be undermined by Hume and challenged precisely because there's a part of that complex concept. It's a complex relation, cause and effect. And that relation involves one idea which simply doesn't have a source in simple ideas of sensation. And therefore, it too must be, for Hume, as for Locke with substance, a something we know not what. But we really need the concept of a causal relation. You can't do science without it. Or at least the science you do will be very different than Descartes thought, Locke thought, who thought there were real causal relations. And so when you gave a scientific explanation, the better ones involved causal principles that were regular and which allowed you to predict the future. Not statistical regularities, right? Where there's a certain probability that the sun will rise tomorrow. But if in fact there are the rising and setting of the sun is an effect based on causal principles, then it ought to be possible to predict what will happen in the future from what happens in the past. One of Hume's critiques of metaphysical habits of explanation in science and in philosophy involves showing that predictions about the future that require an appeal that are derived from experience, from sense perception, and which apply the idea of a necessary connection between cause and effect, will not give us warrant to predict what will happen in the future. And these are called inductive practices, right? We think that predicting the future is exactly how you decide whether a particular scientific theory is a good one or not, right? Answer, right, yes. So these features of Hume's reevaluation of Lockean empiricism lead us away from realism in the direction of what will look like either at least moderate skepticism about our knowledge of the way the world is. And among his critiques, one of the consequences of these critiques is that it is generally the case, at least for scientists who are well informed about how scientific results are justified, tend to reserve judgment about the future, hesitate to make claims about the way the world absolutely is known to be, and always couch their claims about knowledge of the world in terms of the evidence so far in support of a given theory. So far, the broadly Newtonian picture of the gravitational force has survived many centuries of testing. So far, what goes up comes down, except, far away from the nearest gravitational field, where up is a distance away from a larger body, and down is in the direction of the larger body. Okay, so that broad set of comparisons will become clearer to you as we start working through Hume's own refined approach to all of the same. Hume's theory of ideas is essentially Locke's, but it's refined. Okay? And I'm going to give you some of those refinements now. Where Locke had an acquisition principle, Hume adds a memory principle and modifies the acquisition principle with something he calls the correspondence principle. And this is pursuant to two discoveries that Hume makes. One is the discovery, or not so much a discovery, but a criticism, a problem with Locke's theory. Locke says that there are only three kinds of ideas. The original ideas are simple. Remember? Simple ideas of sensation or reflection, or a combination of the two where you can't separate them. And then complex ideas, which are simple ideas combined together in a complex. Or general ideas, which are generated by abstraction from simple ideas of sensation, reflection, or both, right? Well, here's the problem. Locke doesn't really help us to distinguish what was original ideas from non-original ideas. He seems to focus entirely on differences in the content of the ideas. Simple ideas have simple content. Complex or general ideas have complex or general content, right? But it's all one continuum, happy forest full of ideas. Hume thinks that that disguises something that's essential to the empiricist program and which is must be made clear in order to make understandable an important difference among these ideas. Some of these ideas are the originals, and others are not originals. And the acquisition principle and all critiques of concepts of the kind that Locke applied to the concept of a capitalist substance require that you presume that general and complex ideas are derived from simple ideas. And in saying that, Locke has not told us he explains how abstraction works, but he doesn't explain how it is that ideas are available to memory. And he never explains the relationship, really, between memories of things we perceive and the things we originally perceived. But it is the content of what we originally perceived and an assumption about the way those are stored which is implicit in Locke, but never made explicit. So a lot of what Hume does, is to add missing pieces to Locke's picture. One of his first moves is to distinguish between impressions and copies of impressions, a.k.a. ideas. So he now distinguishes between original perceptual content. Those are impressions, right? The immediate content, conscious awareness, both sensory and non-sensory. And then any of those which is available for later inspection is a result of a process of copying in which the content of the impression is copied according to the theory, one for one, you know, part for part, and stored in something in memory which is now called an idea. So that's one of his innovations. Impressions are original content, and ideas are copies of original content, and that justifies the new refined version of the acquisition principle. All ideas are legitimate insofar as they correspond in their content to originating impressions. This tells us what justifies the acquisition claim, principle's claim that all ideas arise from originals. Locke doesn't explain how that works. Hume explains it. It's a process of Xeroxing. And the reason that ideas can be trusted to represent from whence they came is insofar as this process of copying is accurate. And Hume does assume that it is accurate when we're paying close attention as we're perceiving. So this is one of his innovations. And it leads to the correspondence principle and a new role for memory. We're also going to see later that how memory works to support abstraction is something else that Hume puzzled about. I'll talk about that when we get down here to the association principle, if we get to that today, which we won't. So we'll just bracket that for now. But there's a fact about how abstraction works that goes completely unexplained in Locke. And Hume sees that and decides that there needs to be another power of the mind in order for us to be able to do what abstraction suggests we do. Compare things we're currently perceiving to things we've seen before, which requires us recognizing that we've seen things before. And that ability, which is something that seems to come with memory for us, we seem to not just remember what we've, just remember things we've seen, we remember that we've seen something that we're currently seeing. Again, and I'll explain why that is importantly unexplained in Locke next time. So the other thing, other innovation, which I haven't mentioned yet, is that Hume thinks he's discovered there really aren't just two kinds of original simple ideas, but three if you combine the two that can't be separated. But let's just think in terms of sensations and reflections, because the both case is a sort of a special case. So for Locke, there were two kinds of originals, simple ideas of sensation and simple ideas of reflection, right? And Hume agrees with Locke about all those that Locke thought were simple ideas of sensation. He calls those impressions of sensation. The content of those is not changed. That class is unchanged. However, Hume introduces a new group of what he thinks are distinguishable original impressions that Locke treated as part of ideas of reflection, simple ideas of reflection. And the reason that Hume distinguishes them is because he thinks that the cause and ground of impressions of emotion are different from the cause and ground of impressions of reflection. And I'll give you an example to try to motivate it. I kept using along the way in our discussions about what a simple idea of reflection is, I kept pointing to the fact that when we remember something, we're able to detect that it's a memory, right? We don't get confused unless we're hallucinating about whether or our minds are disordered, about whether what we're currently seeing in the mind's eye by way of memory. We don't have trouble distinguishing that from what we're currently seeing, right? And that fact shows that there's something about the way the mind experiences remembered sights that reveals not only the content of what was seen, literally, but also that this is being delivered to consciousness by way of memory, and somehow that affects conscious awareness in a way, that faculty to be a perception, inner and outer perception, that allows us to tell, oh, I'm right now remembering this sight. Remember that sunset, right? And when you're remembering the sunset, you're not only having impressions of sensation, by way of memory. You're getting the content of original impressions of sensation. Actually, you're getting ideas of sensation. But you're noticing that they're memories. And thus, they are actually ideas of reflection also. Insofar as they're a memory, you have an impression of reflection to go with it. Well, an impression of reflection, you might also remember that you were filled with joy when you saw that sunset. And that, Hume thinks, clearly comes from a different source. That's not caused by the act of memory. That's caused by something involving the something in us that generates emotional responses to things that we're currently perceiving. So that seems to come from a different place. It's just a place that isn't out there. And it isn't really in the body either. But where exactly it comes from, whatever it comes from, it comes from something that's obviously different. Emotional content is different than the kind of content that reveals that you're willing something, you're choosing something, you're reflecting on something, you're remembering something, your intellect is engaged and you are inferring one thing from another thing, right? All of those are straightforward cases of impressions of reflection and ideas drawn from them. But ideas of emotion just seem to be different, to have a different source. And since the idea of originals in empiricism is that it straightforwardly depends on a difference in the origin, the cause. Why do we treat sensations as different from reflections? Because they come from somewhere else. I don't generate my sensations. I mean, I do, and I can do that, you know. But there I'm kind of eliding a difference between who I am and, you know, I can hit my body, but that's not me. We're talking about the mind here, and the mind and mental content. And I can have an emotional reaction to that, and I don't think that that my decision to hit myself causes that emotional reaction, except in concert with something else, without which I wouldn't have any emotion about it at all. Right? So so it seems that emotional content comes along with perceptual content, but is different, both from perceptual content of the five senses type, sensations, and also that kind of mental content that comes from noticing or being affected by operations of the mind. Reflection, drawing inferences, remembering, and so on. Okay, so Hume, in being very careful to attend to differences in the quality of incoming impressions, has made, I think, an important distinction, which seems not only to fit common sense, but to preserve something that's essential in the empiricist approach to mental content, which is to separate things that come from distinct places, origins. In the end, it's a kind of causal theory of mental content, that sorts a mental content according to its origins. And there are three origins of mental content. First, he agrees with Locke that the mind is empty until the first sensations arise in consciousness. So he believes in tabula rasa. And the first mental content will always be impressions of sensation, copied and stored in memory. And those ideas will then be ideas that we can then reflect on, remember, compare with each other, and thus generate other ideas, ideas of reflection. And it turns out that human beings have emotional responses to original impressions of sensation, and so we actually get those right away, even without reflecting on our experience as we experience it. This is one of the reasons that people often say, "You made me mad." You know, and it takes a therapist to say, nobody made you mad. Don't confuse your inner states with agents. Your responses are partly what you contribute. You bring emotional responsiveness to the world of your perceptions. that doesn't really help all that much when somebody really pisses you off. But okay, so next time, maybe you will be hearing from me over a little screen at home, and maybe that will make, you know, study time more productive. Who knows? I'll let you know. Okay, see you guys maybe next time.
Hopefully. Do I need a blue book?